The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable James A. Kinect presiding.
This is our case number 4220206, City of Geneseo versus Pyrotim Properties. Would the attorney for the appellant please state your name, introduce yourself to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. Keisha Douglas for the appellant. Pyrotim Properties and Dean Russer.
Thank you. And for the appellee.
Thank you. I'm Megan Mack, attorney for the City of Geneseo.
All right. Ms. Douglas, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. As this court is aware, this is an appeal involving a review of granting a 2619 motion to dismiss and motion for summary judgment. Both parties agree the standard of review is de novo. As this court is well aware, in considering a 2619 motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment, all facts and all inferences therefrom must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving parties, which in this case are Pyrotim and Russer. If any genuine issue of material fact exists, a 2619 dismissal and a motion for summary judgment are inappropriate.
You are cutting out somewhat, and I don't know if it's the microphone or how close you are to it, but I've understood what you've said, but every once in a while a word kind of, there's kind of an ellipse, I suppose I'd say. Go ahead with your argument. Go ahead.
I'll try to speak up. Thank you, Your Honor. Pyrotim and Russer respectfully submit at a minimum a genuine issue a material fact exists, which prohibits the 2619 dismissal and the motion for summary judgment. Count one of the counterclaims states a claim under section 1983 for deprivation of constitutional rights, namely Pyrotim and Russer's procedural and substantive due process rights and the city's demolition of the subject property. That was done without notice with an opportunity to object, in which demolition constitutes an unlawful taking by the city. Additionally, at issue in count one of the counterclaims is the city's conduct of removing personal property items from the subject property, which had value. The city later auctioned those items off, retained the proceeds of the auction. This was done, again, without notice, without an opportunity to be heard, and constitutes an unlawful taking by the city.
Let me interject or ask a question at this point. In simplest terms, I think the city says you had notice, you didn't do anything about it. Or you didn't do what they indicate the statute requires. You're taking a position that that notice was inadequate, or are you taking a position that even if that's true, you have the right to pursue a remedy because of what the city did?
So our argument has many layers to it. One, obviously, the first layer is, I guess it's actually a second layer. The first issue is we don't believe the notice was sufficient under the procedural due process.
You're talking about the original notice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because the certified mailings to Pyrotim and Russer were returned to the sender unclaimed. After they were returned to the sender, the city did not take sufficient steps to notify to ensure Pyrotim and Russer received notice of the intended actions. It's undisputed. There's an affidavit of Mr. Russer in the court record stating he did not have prior notice of the city's intended actions.
Ms. Douglas, let me stop you there and ask you, did they not comply with the statutory requirements of notice? What else did you want them to do?
Yes, they have consistently alleged that they complied with the statutory requirements, and we see that they did comply with the statutory requirements. However, the U.S. Supreme Court in Jones v. Flowers, which is referenced in our brief, the Supreme Court stated that we have required the government to consider unique information about the intended recipients, regardless of whether a statutory scheme is reasonably calculated to provide notice in the ordinary case. When the government has knowledge that notice pursuant to the normal procedures was ineffective, this triggers an obligation on the part of the government to take additional steps to effect notice. And that's our contention here. Once those certified mailings were returned, the record is clear. The city at all times knew of the whereabouts of Mr. Resser. The city had Mr. Resser's personal cell phone number. The city was aware Mr. Resser was the only point of contact for Pyrotin and the subject property. In fact, during preparation for demolition, there was another vehicle on the property, and the city representatives ran the license plate of that vehicle, obtained the owner's information, called the owner, and said, come move your vehicle before we tow it. That same treatment was not provided to Mr. Resser. The city could have equally called Mr. Resser and informed him of the city's removal actions and informed him of the city's intended demolition actions. What we're stating is that even if the statutory notices were sent, they weren't received, and under the circumstances, which is the requirement, the procedural due process requirement, that notice must be reasonably calculated under all circumstances to apprise the intended parties of the pendency of the action and afford them an opportunity to present their objections. It's our position that because we have alleged sufficient facts to show that the city, our position that the city should have taken additional action, that creates a genuine issue of material fact that should be submitted to a jury.
Counsel, let me ask you, what if defendants just said we're not signing for it? Does that make any difference? Is that a problem with your argument?
I don't believe that that was the issue. Those are the facts before us. So I haven't really considered those facts because all of them just said unable to forward for whatever reason for the certified mailing.
Okay, those aren't the facts. What do you mean by that? We know it was mailed, return receipt requested, and no one signed for it. Do we know anything other than that?
No. And my client has stated that he did not receive any certified mailings. He did not receive any U.S. mailings from the city. And so he didn't have actual prior knowledge of the city's intended actions. And as another layer to this, even before we get to the notice issue, Pyrotin and Resser have submitted facts before this court and before the trial court to show that there's a genuine issue of material fact and whether the city complied with step one of the fast track statute, which requires the corporate official designated to be in charge of enforcing the municipality's building code, which was the city building inspector Rick Mills, to determine the building was open and vacant and an immediate and continuing hazard to the community in which it was. During Mr. Mills' deposition, we learned, and during the city representative depositions, we've learned that in July of 2019, the city council learned that their grant application was approved by the state to obtain grant funding to demolish the subject property, among others. After that determination was received by city council immediately after the meeting determined to move forward with the fast track demolition. On or about October 11th, 2019, after that decision was made, the city building inspector created an inspection report with purported code violations based upon a July 11th, 2012 inspection of the subject property. This was the same inspection after which the building inspector informed Mr. Resser via letter that is in the court record that states no code violations exist.
Ms. Douglas, let me go back to the notice issue, because based on what I heard where you talked about a due process violation here, citing the Supreme Court case, you're only saying that the one they could have served was Mr. Resser. Is that correct? In other words, everybody else, there was no ability. The city tried to find the registered agent and all that. So your issue is only with Mr. Resser. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, Mr. Resser, as I recall reading this, he was not listed. The city pulled a title search. He's not listed as the owner or the lien holder, but because they were familiar with him, they knew about him, they actually put him on the service list. But under these facts, was there really a requirement for the city to serve Mr. Resser?
I think based upon the knowledge that the city had dating back to 2008 or 2010, which are in the court records, that every citation that was ever issued to this property named Mr. Resser.
But he's not an owner or lien holder. What is his interest in this property?
He is the sole owner and manager and member of Pyrotin Properties, LLC.
Okay. But he was not on the, as far as this demolition order here, he was not on the subject property's title. So if I do a search for him to find out who are all the people I need to notify because of all the conditions here, the city would never find his name. They happen to know of him, and that's why they tried to serve. That's correct.
I believe that's correct.
Make it.
Thank you. And with respect to the Pyrotin registered agent, the registered agent that had resigned specifically called and informed the city's legal counsel that it was no longer agent for Pyrotin. So, which really left the only person that had an interest in Pyrotin to be Mr. Resser. And as stated, there's various all the notices regarding this property from the city and all the letters regarding this property from the city are all addressed to Mr. Resser. And so they had an implicit understanding that Mr. Resser was the only point of contact that they ever had with the subject property for the subject property, and that Mr. Resser had gone to court on citations, remedied citations, remedied purported code violations in the past with respect to this subject property.
You're saying then that he responded. Go ahead. Sorry, Judge Bridges. Go ahead.
Just so that I'm clear, Mr. Resser's only interest in this case, because he's listed as a defendant in this matter here, is his connection or ownership of Pyrotin.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not the actual building.
Correct.
So that's his issue deals with the fact that the property was removed and sold.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was going to ask Mr. Resser, I think you said he appeared in court or appeared to answer other complaints and other issues over the course of years.
Yes, sir. Sure.
So he received those notices and he responded to them.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Okay.
And I believe those prior notices were issued in a form of citation. There's no evidence in the record in the discovery regarding how those citations were served. During the deposition of Mr. Rick Mills, if he had any knowledge of how those citations were served, and he did not. Those were served through the City of Geneseo Police Department. So, and part of our argument, again, is that the building inspector testified in his deposition that his inspection report did not demonstrate and did not conclude that the subject property was open. In the notice to remediate that is dated October 17th, 2019, it states in relevant part that the subject property is open and vacant and an immediate and continuing hazard to the community in which it's located, as detailed in the attached inspection report, which is the same inspection report that the building inspector testified did not demonstrate and did not conclude that the subject property was open.
Therefore, Council, let me stop you there for a second. On open and vacant, suppose this court doesn't agree with you on notice and we think that the municipality followed the statute. We're now at the foreclosure on the demolishment lien. We're at that stage. So my question is this. If the notice was sufficient, can you still now litigate whether the property was open and vacant as part of the foreclosure action, even though it was never done under the demolition action because the building's gone, it's demolished. So now we're at the lien stage. So are the elements open and vacant still out there to be litigated? You can still proceed. And if you're successful in showing that it wasn't open, then what? The lien would be vacated? Is that where we are? I mean, does that accurately describe the posture of this case right now?
This is an issue of contention between the parties. And it was a key finding by the circuit court and the circuit court took the side of the city of Geneseo and holding that because Pyroton and Russer did not object within 30 days after issuance of the notice to remediate, those objections are now waived and we cannot go back and we cannot relitigate whether the property was open, vacant, and an immediate continuing hazard to the community. Our contention is no waiver. We've cited case law stating that a waiver of a constitutional and statutory right has to be knowing, voluntary, and intentional, where my clients did not have any actual notice of the city's intended actions, there can be no knowing, voluntary, intentional waiver of any rights. So it's our contention that it is open to consideration of whether they did have authority under the statute to demolish the subject property. And again, going back, the first step in the process is that the city was required to have this determination by the city building official. Our contention is the record state shows that no such determination was made. Therefore, the city did not have authority to proceed at all, even issuing the notice to remediate. So it's a twofold situation. Did they comply with step one? And then even if they did comply with step one, are all the defenses regarding the condition of the property, have those been waived? And again, our contention is that those are up for debate and up for determination and there's no waiver. I would like to touch on the notice to quiet or count two, the quiet title action. There were three liens involved in that. One was the utility lien, which indisputably has been paid and has indisputably not been released by the city. The second is the mowing lien. Pyroton and Russer have identified the various requirements for the city to be entitled to a mowing lien. The city has failed to provide any evidence to satisfy those elements of the mowing lien. So those two liens should quiet title, as far as the quiet title actions should not have been dismissed. As for the demolition lien, the undisputed evidence in the record is the city hasn't been damaged. They applied for a grant, they received a grant, they have been reimbursed for all costs of demolition. Therefore, there is nothing to enforce. They have to demonstrate damage. They have to demonstrate costs incurred and damage. They cannot, as a matter of law, do that. And they have failed to provide this court with any authority that they have any type of legal obligation to try to recover those funds to pay those back, because that requirement simply doesn't exist. Therefore, it's a non-starter for the foreclosure petition. Summary judgment should not have been granted, and count one and some of the defenses should not have been dismissed. As far as the Tort Immunity Act, there's judicial admissions in the record by the city administrator in the building inspector that the decision to demolish, the decision to move the fast track statute was a decision of the city council, the legislative body of the city. And Mr. Mills was simply carrying out those decisions and determinations. Therefore, the Tort Immunity Act is inapplicable. And I know I'm low on time, so I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have time on rebuttal. Ms. Mack?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the court, Megan Mack on behalf of the City of Geneseo. As you correctly just referred to, this case started with the filing of the city's foreclosure petition, and that was on our fast track demolition lien. Just to note, the fast track demolition process started in October 17th of 2019. You have seen an affidavit from Mr. Russer that he first learned of the demolition on the property from a colleague that observed the demolition in process. After the demolition was completed on February, apologize, I'm jumping all over my notes here. February 14th, it was completed. The city had until February 14th to complete it under the statute. We filed this foreclosure petition May 15th of 2020, and no time in between that did Mr. Resser ever contact the city to even complain that his house had been demolished. I would submit to you that's because he was aware of it. He was aware because he chose not to open that certified mail. As you have already questioned Ms. Douglas on, the city did send certified and regular mail to all of the addresses that it could find for Pyrotown properties. It was not obligated to send to Dean Resser as he was not a lien holder.
But why did they send all the other notices to him?
I'm sorry, which notices, Your Honor?
Well, all these citations that were referred to. I mean, so, I assume that's in the record.
So prior to the fast track demolition, all of those citations would have been taken, would have been sent to Mr. Resser from people at City Hall. When we initiated this, we actually pulled title, and that's the title commitment showed that there was no actual relationship to the property. It was all through Pyrotem Properties. And so that's why conforming to the statutory requirements, it was more appropriate that Pyrotem Properties be served, but that the certified mail be sent to Pyrotem Properties. And that's why we bent over backwards to do that.
You also said he refused to open it.
That's my belief.
Isn't in the record.
I would agree with you, Judge, it's not in the record. What I think is interesting, though, is that all along, prior to this case, as well as even after when we started the foreclosure proceedings, everything that the city sent to Mr. Resser was to this 323 Vale Street address. And Mr. Resser received everything that we sent there, including the regular mail that was not returned to sender. And the summons that we served him in the foreclosure, he got there. So it's interesting that the certified mail was the only thing that then came back to us.
Counsel, Ms. Mack, if I can ask you this, I've read, as all of you have, section 1131.1e, and I don't find any limitation period that would bar defendants' counterclaims in this case. So under what statutory basis do you find such a limitation?
We believe that there's a 30-day period to contest this based on the fact that that's how the statute was written, that within 30 days, you need to file something with the circuit court if you want to stop the fast-track demolition. Otherwise, the city is then empowered to go ahead and demolish that building. So at that point, there's the court, if you were to then file into the circuit court something to stop that fast-track, the circuit court wouldn't actually have jurisdiction to take a pleading related to stop that.
Let me ask you this, because isn't that position that you've taken at odds with, I believe it's section 147 of chapter 65 of the municipal code that provides that municipalities can be liable for wrongful demolition, even when it's pursuant to a valid statute. So that seems to say that even though this statute provides 30 days, which again, I still don't see as a limitation, that there is a remedy or recourse for individuals that believe the property has been wrongfully demolished.
I do agree with you, Your Honor, in that 1-4-7 under the municipal code does allow for a wrongful demolition action. However, that was never pled in any of this case. The first time that 1-4-7 was alleged was in the appeal filing here. And in the cases that counsel references that give additional time to her clients to be able to argue that the notice elements or what was contained, which made up the open and vacant, her open and vacant arguments, those actually were all related to Kate. Those, I believe that she's citing the Ballinger City of Danville case and the Harvest Church of Our Lord case. And both of those cases specifically had actions for wrongful demolition under section 1-4-7. And that's just simply not the argument here. That was never alleged.
Let's assume this wasn't a demolition situation that we have here, but rather it was one where it was remedial repairs or to remove debris or unhealthy material. And so you're saying that if the property owner in that case didn't respond within 30 days, they would have no recourse. They couldn't come into court and argue about the repairs because the statute allows not just demolition, repairs. So it would seem to me that they would still have the ability to seek a court approval of what is going on or what has happened to the property.
I think the intent of the statute was to allow for these unusual circumstances where the city feels there's an immediate danger and a hazard to the community. And as I was going to get into my argument about the open and vacant, the building inspector's opinion was that this building did create that. There was a tree growing underneath the structure of the property. You could not physically see the door as you walked to the property because there was so much brush and overgrowth. In that case, it was not safe for law enforcement and emergency personnel if they needed to respond to try and get there. Because the structure of the building was compromised from the tree growing underneath, we had open windows where, again, trees were growing into the property. This unique subsection of the municipal code allows for municipalities to take action quicker than if they were to choose to do so under subsection A. And so the legislature, as they crafted this little subsection E of the code, provides that that the city has an obligation to complete notice in many forms. It's not a quick process to go through publication, certified mail, recording, and well as posting. And then therefore, there's only 30 days to respond. But after that, I believe you don't have standing then to contest it.
Well, I know there's testimony here in the record where the inspector talked about, I believe he said the windows were not properly sealed because he saw exterior growth. But the issue I have here is that the building inspector testified that he first entered the building on January 30th. 7 days before the demolition, and he had to pry open the back door. Correct. And so what makes this open and the vacant?
Because
when in fact, it seems though from his testimony, this was all sealed up.
Well, two things, Your Honor. One, vacant in that no one was inhabiting there. And just because you leave belongings or personal effects in there does not mean that the residence was occupied. You'll also see that he also testified that there had been no utilities or running water on that property since 2005. Open also meaning that open to the elements is in a property maintenance term where the windows were open, allowing for trees and limbs to pierce those windows. And as he also did testify to, there were animals inside the property. So open to the elements doesn't necessarily always mean that just because an animal can get in there, the building inspector could get in without having to have a crowbar or pry bar to open the doors, but it was open and exposed to anyone else to or animals to have gotten in there. And I guess anyone else who may have tried harder than he did, but he wasn't going to do it that way. Some of the cases that were cited by counsel, I would just like to point out the differences. She talked about Jones v. Flowers and that there were an elevated duty on what is deemed to be service. And I would just let you just also recite something from that case. The court also explained in Jones v. Flowers that there were several reasonable steps that could have been taken when certified letters to Jones were returned unclaimed. And the steps that they cited were notice could have been resent by regular mail. And here, notice was sent that way. Two, notice could have been posted on the front door. Here we know it was posted on the property. Three, notice could have been addressed to the occupant. And again, we know that that was also done. Several of the cases that are cited, also one being Doonesbury, which was a case involving a cash forfeiture. The court stated there that due process does not require heroic efforts by the government to assure the notice's delivery. And that is the case here, that the city had a duty to send certified mail, but the city did not have an obligation to ensure that that certified mail was received. And because the city had complied with all the other statutory obligations as to notice, it had complied with that. And in addition, the city had also invited Mr. Resser to a meeting, Mr. Resser or anyone from Pyroton Properties, to a meeting at City Hall, which no one from that business bothered to attend. I don't know where I am on time. I don't know if you have any questions. I've kind of jumped around all of my argument. Apologize for that.
Not at all. I don't see any other questions, but you still have time remaining if you wish to make some points.
And then just to I think clarify, is there, because I think it is somewhat confusing, some of the pictures that are attached to the notice to remediate are from 2012. The reason being for that is in 2012, this property was so bad that a court did allow it for an administrative search warrant. And that's when the inspector did have actual entrance to the property. So when he wrote his inspection report in 2019, he was taking those photographs from the exterior of the property. You're correct, Judge Bridges, in that when he was not able to go back into the property until January, and that was as a well-being check prior to the demolition. But he was able to confirm from his peripheral walk around the property and from peering into the windows, because there were open elements, that he could see that there had been no permits pulled. Well, he knew there had been no permits pulled to the property and that there had been no activity on the property in towards of a repair, and that the conditions had only gotten worse over the years, which was accompanied by all of the complaints that the city continued to have about this property. As to the IDA grant that the city did apply for, they applied for IDA grants for several properties. The city council did decide to use the IDA grant for the demolition of this property, knowing that if it was going to go to foreclosure on the lien, that the IDA grant would be paid back. However, the city didn't make that decision until the building inspector had an opportunity to weigh into the conditions of the property and inform the city council as to the nature and conditions that exist on that property as well. I think I've hit most of my arguments, even though I didn't do so in a very careful way. I apologize for that.
That's all right. We asked you questions. Have you concluded?
Yes, thank you.
All right. We'll hear from you on rebuttal, Ms. Douglas.
If anyone has any questions, please let me know. I do find it interesting that the city's council references unusual circumstances. This was such a hazardous property. What was hazardous about this? There was an inspection done in 2012. After that inspection was done, a letter was issued to Mr. Resser saying no code violations exist. Then, however many years later, 7 years later, the city all of a sudden gets a grant to demolish the property. And now all of a sudden, it's an urgent hazard to the community. the building inspector testified his inspection report from 2019 is based in large part upon his 2012 inspection of the property. It doesn't make sense. We cannot reconcile these situations. And again, the record shows the city never considered using subsection A of the statute, which requires a petition to a court requesting a court order to remediate the property. That would ensure that there is due process, the interest of personally served, an opportunity to be heard. That subsection A is for dangerous and unsafe properties. And the courts have looked at that and analyzed that in comparison with subsection E. There is a difference between dangerous and unsafe and an immediate and continuing hazard to the community, which we don't have here. A tree supposedly growing under a foundation, which is not in the record, by the way. There's no record that this was structurally unsound. So the building clearly did not meet the standard. There's emails in the record between city representatives and the hospital, which is adjacent to the subject property and who is interested in purchasing the subject property, about how can we acquire title to this property. This was the only reason action was actually initiated, to attempt to acquire title to the property, not to recover demolition costs, because those demolition costs have already been recovered by the city. The intent was an unlawful taking, and that's what we have here. Ms. Mack mentioned, well, Mr. Bester knew of the demolition in February, but didn't complain about it. What was he going to do? Structure was demolished. You know, what was his objection going to be to the city? What difference would that have made? It wouldn't have made a difference. That's my position. As to Ms. Mack's argument that subsection E forecloses judicial review of the city's actions, I don't read that subsection barring judicial review of the city's actions. It requires a period of time for an opportunity to be heard. Clearly, Mr. Ruskin and Carleton did not have an opportunity to be heard when they had no knowledge of the city's intended actions.
Council, before you run out of time, I see that you've asked us to reverse and remand. If we do that, what's going to happen when we send it back to trial court?
I think there'll probably be additional discovery. We did file a cross motion for summary judgment as to several issues that the trial court did not rule on and didn't consider. So that would be determination, and to narrow down what the genuine issues of material fact are. And really what we need from this court is, you know, is this reviewable? Is the city's actions reviewable? Is it an issue of fact for the jury to determine, or the trier of the fact to determine whether the condition of the property was adequately met to authorize the city to move forward with the demolition? The circuit court seems to think that all of those arguments are barred because of the statute, because Pyrotim and Russer somehow waived their right to make any objections under the statute. So that's a major determination that we're looking for from this court as far as instructions, but it would be definitely more discovery and ultimately a trial. And as far as the city's arguments regarding the open windows, there's no in the record regarding any open windows. The only evidence in the record is the windows weren't properly sealed. There's also no evidence in the record regarding animals inside the property. There was an acorn or something. I'll conclude. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement. We thank you for your arguments.